Oh, we're being snarky puppied up this morning. Good morning and welcome to the roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. I'm your host. It's very nice to be back. I was away for a couple of days. Sarah LaDuke, thank you very much for filling in. And it's good to be back. I was in Florida. And I really don't know why. But I was in Florida with the family, and the family consists of my wife, her mother, her brother, his wife, their three children, and associated significant others. So it's a big group. It's a very big group, and I don't think anything spells success for a holiday quite like a real field temperature of 108 and family drama, right? I mean, that's just mixed stern and joy. That was great. But it was lovely. It was wonderful spending time with them. And it's pretty wonderful to be back too. very, very nice. And then I come in, we leave. It's so hot. I get into Albany yesterday afternoon, and it's so hot. And then I wake up this morning, and it's like 65 degrees. Yeah. I was like, what? That's great. That was fantastic. I mean, I could do without the rain, but that's all right. So good morning, everyone. Welcome. It's wonderful to be back. It's wonderful to talk to you all and to go through what we're going to go through here over the next 2 hours. Let me introduce the group, and we will get started on doing just that. We welcome former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, longtime editor at the Daily Gazette, Judy Patrick. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. You know, speaking of big family groups, so this is summer's time when a lot of families have big family reunions, and this weekend is the time when every Patrick within 200 or 300 miles descends on my house. Oh, get ready.
Where are you going?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's lovely. It's really nice to see everybody, and it is good to catch up.
But there's a butt coming.
No.
As long as you do. They all leave.
I had two things going for me, Robert. One was I had the keys to the rental car at all times. and two, you know where the exits are. You know, those are the things that you need to have. Robert, that I mentioned, is Robert Pendicio. He is senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and a pleasure to have him here this morning. Good morning,
thanks,
Robert.
Joe. Nice
How
to be
you?
Back. I'm well.
Excellent. We welcome Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler. Hello, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing okay, Joe. My family story is my child is now a resident of New York as of today instead of Massachusetts. Living up in Clifton Park, and the drama of the last day of the move had some of us at 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning calling motels halfway between Boston and New York to so they could have 2 hours of rest with their kitten while on the way. But, they are successfully there, and the movers are due any minute now.
Excellent. Well, we wish them well. It's I don't know. I mean, it's cooler, which is good. It's a shame that it's raining, but hopefully it'll.
Well, they're moving from a studio basement in Stoneham, Mass., in a poorly maintained apartment complex, to a 2-bedroom above ground at a nice place in Clifton Park, and it only saves $300 a month.
Moving on up. I remember when I was a young person doing exactly the opposite, going from a $260 a month half a house to a $1,000 a month windowless basement apartment on Long Island. So,
yes, that's, like they've that's what my nieces and nephews are going through. You wouldn't believe how much it costs to live in Boston.
Oh, yes, I would.
Yes, I would. Yes, I would.
Amazing.
You brought a student with you, Jim. Sophia's been with us in the past. We're thrilled that she's back. Introduce Sophia.
Well, I'm actually going to let Sophia introduce herself because Sophia is no longer here as a student of mine. The class is over. It's just did so well the first time that I thought we'd see if you wanted her back.
Sophia Aquisto, I'm right.
Aquisto, yes.
Yes, and it's wonderful to have you back. Thank you very much for being here. You are, what we remember about you is you're a former grade school teacher.
Yes, used to be an elementary teacher. Now I'm going into my second year as a PhD student at RPI.
And in what field?
Science and technology studies, which I know sounds very sciencey, but it's very humanities-centered, very interdisciplinary. I'm a history teacher originally, so I'm working on using digital maps to tell the Hudson Valley's history.
Oh, wow. So that's great. And then the ultimate goal being?
I would really like to work for the Department of Education, maybe make history curriculum better with technology. I'm graduating
you,
2028, so I'd like to think I'll be part of the Reconstruction era.
Okay, because I'm not telling you, you are far more sophisticated and smarter than I am. But in the future, when you answer that question, I would just preface it by saying State Department of Education.
Yes, in Albany, that's what I mean. 20 minutes away from RPI.
That's right, exactly. Sophia, it's a delight to have you here.
Thank you very much for
being with us. We look forward to hearing your views on a wide range of subjects as we work our way through the news cycle. And I try to keep track of what has been discussed over the last couple of days. If we start to repeat something, I'm sure I'll be notified. But I think I figured this out, that we're not going to go over new stuff. And really, that brings up another point of what actually is new. But here we go. Tariff deadlines. See? That's an example. We were talking about that before I left last Friday. Trump is threatening new tariffs on India as Friday deadline for the deals nears. And this is the president saying yesterday that these tariffs, he's sticking with this deadline, a self-imposed August 1st deadline before broad new taxes on imports kick in, though he also cast doubt on striking a deal with India, another of the United States' largest trading partners. South Korea was set to face a 25% tariff beginning Friday when rates are set to go up on dozens of countries. Trump earlier Wednesday posted on Truth Social, his social media platform, that the Friday deadline stands strong and will not be extended. That was in all shouty caps. In the early evening, Trump wrote that South Korea imports will face a 15% tariff rate instead, and that the country will invest $350 billion in the U.S., directed by the White House, plus purchase $100 billion in American energy. South Korea is the country's ninth largest trading partner, according to federal data. India is the 12th largest. The U.S. and South Korea have an existing trade agreement that Trump negotiated during his first term. The president of South Korea welcomed the deal, which landed after negotiations started only last month when the president took office, the South Korean president took office. And so now we wait to see what the rest of these will bring. The presidential office yesterday in South Korea said that after the announcement that South Korean autos will face 15% tariffs, the announcement is a framework of an agreement. Right? Framework of an agreement. Finalized trade deals are massive and can take years to negotiate, but if the arrangement with South Korea is implemented, the White House will have brokered new arrangements with 11 of the country's top 15 trading partners. All right. Who would like to begin? Robert?
Why do you do this to me, John?
I'm sorry.
No one else wants to throw themselves on the grenade. I've become the Mikey of, just ask Mikey. He'll talk about
it.
He'll
eat it. Everything.
And I'm glad you got the reference. I just realized that was kind of a dated one. Man, okay. Would you have predicted the first time we talked about tariffs on this program months ago that he would have had 11 out of 15? So credit where credit is due. Whenever we talk about tariffs on the roundtable, which seems to be a hearty perennial, I always do the same thing. I go on CNBC.com and look at Dow futures, and they're up. So, this is the same point I made last time. The market seems to have reached some equilibrium about tariffs. They don't have the panic response that they used to. So that's good. There was a really interesting discussion about this yesterday, and I'll put in a plug for one of my employers. I do a lot of work for Commentary Magazine. They've got a terrific daily podcast. And David Bahnsen, who's a financial guy, was on there, and he is, you know, no fan of Trump, let's be clear. He raised a really interesting point along with Matt Continetti, who's my boss's boss at AEI. They were talking about, and I hadn't really thought about this, just the way the rationale for tariffs has changed over time. So initially, they were saying tariffs were promoted to, you know, and they gave 4 points. One, close the trade deficit. Two, reindustrialize by onshoring manufacturing jobs. Raise revenue, number three, and enhance national security from, you know, decoupling from China, for example, and other potential rivals. Well, now, 6 months later, the arguments have shifted around tariffs. Now it's about opening markets, it's about increasing foreign direct investment, and it's about raising revenue. So on the one hand, you know, the those who were panicked by and look, you know, as somebody who is center right, I don't love tariffs, never will. I'm a free trade guy. So on the one hand, they have not had the deleterious effects many of us have feared, at least not yet. That's the other point that they made on this podcast, was like, the jury's still out. Let's talk in a year. But you got to take note of that shifting rationale. I thought that was an interesting insight.
Judy. So, oh, go ahead, Jim.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, Joe, you know, I've been looking into some of this, digging into data, because that's what I do for fun. And, you know, what was interesting is you look at the trade imbalances with most of these countries, and it makes sense that it seems like we have a overall, so we import more from India than we export, according to all of the official things, unless you include services. Hmm. The minute you include services, which, by the way, the tariffs don't impact, the U.S., trade. So if you take the total dollars with India, we're actually exporting more than we're importing when you include services. And it turns out with most of these other countries, that's there too. So I think one of the things that's very interesting, and I hope you'll, if Aaron's here tomorrow, I hope you'll ask him about this, is that
Aaron will be here tomorrow.
Good. That these numbers we're reading about on tariffs and trade and things like that are all talking about the physical things being traded, and not really the actual dollars that are moving in many ways. And I think that, you know, I don't know how that changes anything, but you can see where some of that would cause markets who do know this, are sophisticated enough to understand this stuff, to say, okay, steel may go up, but, you know, that's not going to really impact what we do in a lot of our big tech businesses.
Out of my depth here, but does that explain why the market is no longer overreacting to the tariff news?
You know, I think there's two possibilities. One is the market is smart enough to see this. The other is the market is even smarter to realize that tomorrow's news will be different than today's.
Right. I think the markets are also thinking burned that perhaps out. The courts will overturn this and say that the Trump administration has gone too far in maintaining this as an emergency, undergirding its rationale for imposing these tariffs. You know, I agree. I think it's too soon to tell. I can tell you, as I'm a big transparency person, I like to know what's what. And I think since, was it Freedom Day or Liberation Day that we had when he announced all this with the, was it Liberation?
Liberation Day.
So Freedom Day
is every day.
The lack of concrete detail in all of these things. I mean, that's why I laughed so heartily when you said a framework of a deal. It's like it's so loosey-goosey. We don't know whether South Korea is actually really going to invest money back in the U.S. And I think all of this back and forth.
It's like saying we have a firm whim.
And all this back and forth, it just clouds the overall principles we're talking about. So initially we said tariffs were going to, the idea was to, you know, revive American industrial manufacturing. It's like, yeah, I don't know. I don't hear that much anymore. The Democrats will say that, you know, this is a tax on American goods. And So what we've seen a lot so far is the manufacturers are eating the increased tariffs, but I don't know how long they're going to be able to do this. All I can tell you is that when I buy my orange juice now, the carton is a lot smaller. The shrinkflation has really upped its game. We run out of orange juice in 3 days rather than 5 days now because it looks like it's a little the same size, but it's much smaller.
Well, I don't think that's new to tariffs. That's been going on for
a decade. Increased. It's increased. It's 10 or 15 years old.
Okay.
But man, it has accelerated in a massive way in the last, I would say, 3 months. So, I think of free trade, encourage the proliferation of dollar stores, and now we're $1.25 stores. I think we're going to go up to $1.50 stores soon, and so I won't buy as many.
Five below.
I won't buy as many foam noodles for the pool as I usually do.
That's exactly why I go there. Sophia.
Well, I will admit I'm not super well-versed in economics, but I did learn that our biggest imports from India are pharmaceuticals, car parts, gemstones. So I know you were talking about orange juice, and I was wondering, what are the price changes that consumers are going to see, like the everyday Americans are going to see, like, or who's going to be most affected? Like, I don't know what pharmaceuticals exactly includes or what kind of car parts, but I was kind of wondering, like, what populations are going to be the most vulnerable to these changes?
Well, I mean, the economy is 75% consumer, right? So one assumes that broad-based tariffs mean broad-based price increases sooner or later.
Mm. Right, but on goods. I mean, it's on services, not so much.
Insight.
So people who are consumers of services, like who have their house cleaned or buy country club memberships, I think they are going to be less affected than people who are buying pasta and avocados and olive oil and bananas. Those increases can add up. The question is, when will it hit? I mean, the dire consequences that we heard after Liberation Day or Freedom Day talked a lot about Christmas buying. We'll see what happens when Christmas buying season happens.
I am just delighted that my friends on the left have joined us in their opposition to tariffs. Welcome aboard.
Well,
30 seconds.
Long time. But I'm just going to say real quick that, again, I do think once again you see that who are the firms that are going to profit the most by this? Well, those will be the firms that import the least steel and provide the most services. Mm. The greatest number of those are Silicon Valley and the other tech giants, which seems to be who Trump has been kowtowing to.
Are you sure about that? I mean, the manufacturing that's what.
Well, they manufacture overseas, but a lot of it is not. I mean,
that's one of
there are a lot
arguments.
Of these issues. But when you trade off the cost of how much software they provide out versus how much steel come in,
we'll hash all this out when we come back after a quick break. I mean, we probably won't, but we'll try. We'll do that right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this July 31st. It is a Thursday, the last day of the seventh month of this year. And tomorrow we'll be into to August. Let the dog days begin. So we go to a bunch of letters regarding this topic, unless anybody wants to make another point before we do so. Hearing none, I will go to letters.
Let's hear from the people.
Let's hear from the people.
Yeah.
Stephanie says, a deal is not a contract or an agreement, in my opinion. A deal is a smokescreen created by President Trump to say what he wants and won't necessarily get. That from a listener, we go to Chris. Please explain, if the profit margin on a given product is typically 15% and a new tariff is 15%, where's the incentive to be in this business at all?
The argument we're hearing from companies or from people who are speaking in support of companies is they're willing to take some short-term pain primarily to appease the Trump administration and to make sure their consumers are not terribly upset with them, but how long they're willing to do this. And also, they also have to keep their shareholders in mind, because the shareholders expect profits. They expect those dividend checks. So I think that's a short-term approach that the companies are taking, those that are doing that.
I want to touch on something that Robert said earlier, because I believe this to be true, that if you look at 11 of the 15, and when we originally had this...
I thought we were talking 75 originally.
90.
Oh.
90, but this is of our main trading partners.
Of our top trading partners.
Of our top trading partners. Right. 11 of the 15. I don't, and you're right, but I don't think we would have, we would have agreed that anybody would have thought that this would have happened. But I'm interested in places like Canada, mm-hmm. and where not only is there not a deal being made, but they're not interested in making a deal, and they're still, what's the word, bitter.
I thought we were annexing them.
Hmm?
I'm being a smart aleck. I thought okay. We were annexing them anyway.
Oh, yes.
In Greenland,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, in Greenland. That's right. But I mean, that's interesting in and of itself, I think.
Oh, it's incredibly interesting. And like in the newspaper business, a lot of newsprint comes from Canada. Yeah. A lot of we import a lot of aluminum from Canada, and that's the plates that the newspapers use to make their to print their newspapers. A lot of us go to Canada to visit for vacation. It's a lovely place to go this time of year. It's a great trading partner. They've long been our friends, and man, are they mad at us.
They are.
Well, and you look at the numbers of people, not just from Canada, but from around the world coming to the U.S., and tourism is way down. Students, right? I think I've said this before on the show, but it's worth repeating, that my European friends constantly thank me for Trump, because they say it's the best thing that's ever happened to European universities, because now the top students from, you know, India and China, which have been our primary source of foreign students, they're now opting not to come to the U.S., and it's sort of hard to blame them. And so, you know, one of my colleagues who's at what would be rated a second or third rate European school said they used to get people from low-end universities in India. Now they're getting the top IIT students who all used to come to the U.S.
So. And sometimes it's not even opting. Like, the international students don't feel like they can come to the U.S. anymore, or they may be blocked, or, yeah, there's a lot of barriers now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the retaliation aspect of this is yet to be measured. I think we'll see what the nations who are succumbing to these kind of bullying trade deals, you know, how they react. I mean, the governments can negotiate any kind of deal, but the power of the consumer is something that we need to reckon with. We'll see whether, like in Canada, they're not buying Kentucky bourbon. And, you know, and what is France going to do? What is England going to do in terms of not buying our, what is China doing in terms of not buying our soybeans? I mean, what is going to be the impact on the farming industry as people get really annoyed at us? We have the clout of a big consumer nation, but overusing it can be dangerous.
Well, and the reciprocal tariffs. So, you know, again, if it's suddenly going to be cheaper in another country to buy a Chinese product than an American product, the consumers are going to make those decisions.
Well, that's
not
true
the manufacturers.
Now, right? By and large. I mean, we haven't been a leading manufacturer for decades.
No, exactly. But I'm saying, but now supposedly the tariffs help us do much more manufacturing and fix some of our trade imbalances. Yeah. The trade imbalances go away because people just aren't buying anything.
Can we go back to something you mentioned earlier, Jim, before the break and we got cut off? Because, you know, and again, I've already established that I'm not a fan of tariffs. But the one argument for tariffs that I do find compelling is, to a limited degree, onshoring of manufacturing. You know, I'm in favor of good high-paying jobs. And yes, even union jobs. But the strategic aspects of it, you were talking about the tech industry as being mostly a service business, but that to me is the shining example of one where onshoring manufacturing, whether it's rare earths or just, you know, fabrication, makes a ton of sense.
You know, it's a long conversation, and it gets into scale. It gets into how much you're paying your workers. and gets into how 20 that's going to impact.
Well, no. Take your time.
I mean, just an example, yeah. Right? If my iPhone's going to cost four times as much because it's made in the U.S.,
yeah.
Right?
But if China shuts off rare earths, for example, then not only is it going to cost more, it's not going to be available.
Right, exactly. And then also, you know, now suddenly that Sanyo one, that the 15% tariff right. is going to look a lot better than that U.S. one that had to pay the workers significantly more. Now, that said, you know, the liberal side of me would love to see workers around the world doing better and would like to see us not exploiting.
I'd like to see workers here in the U.S. everywhere. Doing better. Right. But I mean, do we, even those of us who don't like tariffs, can we agree that there is at least some strategic logic here, that there's it is in our interest to onshore manufacturing, for example, and safeguard strategic interests?
I think I would definitely agree with the strategic interests. I think onshoring of manufacturing
well, they're the same
gets
thing
to be a
in
much,
this instance.
Depends on the what you're making and how you're making it and what
okay.
you mean by national security. And I spent much of my life in that, so I won't go on in great detail.
He could tell us, but he'd have to kill us.
That's right. That's what it sounds
no,
like,
I mean, you know, that's the famous expression, but the real answer is I'd tell you, but then they'd throw me in jail for the rest of my life, which is even worse.
So the president this morning talked about this and said it would be very hard, quote, very hard to make a trade deal with Canada after it said it may recognize Palestine as a state. It was the president's latest threat against an ally on the eve of tomorrow's deadline for countries to agree to trade deals or face tariffs of up to 50%. Hours earlier, Mr. Trump said imports, because we talked about South Korea, but Mr. Trump said imports from India would be subject to a 25% tariff as of Friday if a deal is not reached. And then there is the Brazil conflict. Mr. Trump applied 50% tariffs to products from Brazil and imposed sanctions on the Supreme Court justice overseeing the criminal case against the former president Bolsonaro, escalating the diplomatic crisis between the Western Hemisphere's two most populous nations. The tariffs against Brazil are the highest that the U.S. has imposed on the country this year, though they exclude many of Brazil's key exports. And then, of course, we did mention the South Korea deal. I am interested in the panel's thoughts on both India and Brazil.
Hey, those kind of truth social posts fortify any arguments that the opposition to these tariffs will make to the courts, because the argument of the administration is these are emergency economic measures. And the fact that President Trump is very clearly tying them to totally unrelated economic policy issues undermines his administration's case entirely. I mean, he couldn't be more clear about this. I don't know. But again, who knows what's going to happen with these courts?
Are we sure that this is not within his purview? I mean, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but
the Constitution says
the treaties, right, is what the Constitution says.
The Constitution gives clear authority for tariffs to the
tariffs
to the
as well.
To the Congress,
okay.
yeah. They've abdicated that since the 1920s to some extent, mm-hmm. but not as effusively as they have, or as Trump has done in terms of seizing this control. I mean, yeah. it's in the Constitution.
Well, look, I like executive yeah. orders as much as I like tariffs. So.
Which means you do not. Well,
that is yeah. what that means, yes. but, you know.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said in an interview on CNBC this morning that he believed we have the makings of a deal on trade with China, but that a few technical details still need to be worked out. Any agreement is expected to lead to a 90-day extension of the two countries' trade truce, which is set to expire on August 12th.
So, yeah, again, these are ever-moving deadlines.
And by the way, it's also worth noting that in these—
But it was in shouty caps before, that these are not going to move.
Right. But in these 11 out of the 15— a number of them, the tariffs are just what they were before.
Mm-hmm.
So the deal was to just restore back to, you know, they charge us, we charge them. So I don't know. It's
when in doubt, I look at the markets, and the markets are still up, so nobody's panicking there. And this is their job to read those tea leaves, right?
You know, I think that to some extent that's less true than it once was. First of all, just look at the churn in the market, where it can be down 1,000 one day and up 800 the next day. That's something we've rarely seen before.
Haven't seen that churn
lately. And I think, but how much of that is the same as my emotional response to many of the articles I read about this administration? Has reached the point where the antidepressants are keeping
at the risk of an inelegant analogy. You're comparing the market to a battered spouse.
In some ways, I think that's not totally untrue. I think what the market has figured out is, let's stick with what's going on here. Let's look at what the Fed is doing here, and you know we'll see how. Just like you guys both said, you know, we'll wait 6 months to see the tariffs. Well, supposedly the market is a predictor out 3 to 6 months.
And look, I think that is the one earnest, serious point to make here, which is that it's enjoyable to talk about these things, but it's going to be a while before the egg makes it through the python, so to speak.
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that this was enjoyable.
It's not Epstein, okay? We're not talking about Epstein. the duck just came down.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. We always welcome you to join in on the fun. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, if you would like to share your thoughts on this issue and others. Panel at WAMC.org. We will continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is 9:48 on this Thursday morning, the 31st of July. I just two little programming notes that I want to mention. One is that coming up at 11:30 this morning, we're going to talk to New York Times journalist Tim Weiner, who has a brand new New York Times bestselling book, which is called The Mission, the CIA in the 21st century. And this is basically a post 9/11 look at the CIA, what it has become, what it is now, and the grave, grave concerns that Tim Weiner has over the current operation of this Central Intelligence Agency. So we will talk to Tim Weiner coming up at 11:30 this morning. Also, I want to make mention of something. Just a few weeks ago when we had an emergency fund drive because the federal government cut our funding, the White House cut funding to public media, and we came on in the morning from 9 to noon, and then we came back from 2 to 5, and we talked to you, and we made a lot of money and to help fill our gap. And you were as generous as we could have ever imagined. I don't think any of us imagined you would be as generous as you were, and you were. One of the things that was so interesting to us was that you, because we were talking about, look, we're going to be okay. We think we're going to be okay, but we're worried about the small rural stations out there who are really going to have a tough, tough time. And so many of you, because you are WAMC listeners, and this is what we expect of you, that you ask for ways to support rural stations who do this important work and who face such a steep climb after these large cuts are made. So we heard you. And tomorrow from 9 to 9:30, the first half hour of this program, 9 to 9:30, we are going to introduce you to our friends at North Country Public Radio, just to our north. Their station manager will join our CEO, Sarah Gilbert. I'll be moderating, I don't know, doing whatever, just telling people when to call and the like. And we'll talk about the important work that North Country Public Radio does and to answer any questions that you might have and how the two organizations are working together. And so we are not permitted to ask you for donations to another organization on the air, but you can certainly find their donation page and help them. And we just want to make you aware of the great work that they do so that we can help them. And we hope you're as generous with them as you have been with us. And I know many of you, many, many of you, especially in our neck of the woods, Judy, Patrick, listen to both stations. And so it is, it's very important. And we're going to be doing that tomorrow from 9 until 9:30. So we do welcome you to join us for that. And then beginning at 9:30, we will go from 9:30 to 11 with our panel discussion. All right, let's go to some letters. We begin with Peter. Let's face it, the American workers will not benefit in any way from the tariffs. Average Americans have not benefited from the machinations of either party over the last 30 years. The Republicans are anti-democratic racists, and in the pockets of the wealthy, the Democrats are inept and incapable of implementing any program designed to improve the lives of the average American. I'm done with both the Democrats and Republicans, fascists. That is from Peter, who is a veteran and a retired public school teacher. All right.
Why, well, I can see Musk's party already has one voter.
Hey, I'm a registered independent, so, you know, I'm not sure I'd phrase it the way Peter just did, or my logic might not be the same, but yeah.
Then we go to John. Judy Patrick asked, when will it hit? And that's a $64,000 question. The media is talking about months or a year from now. What about 5 years from now when major trading partners have gradually built up more trade between themselves and less with the United States of America? When the U.S. market is no longer the juggernaut that free trade made it in the first place, it seems to me that this is what we should be thinking about. The future, that is John.
So,
checking in. Yes.
So let me comment on that without getting too specific enough to get thrown in jail. But food security.
What are you going to say?
Food security in the U.S. has been largely dependent on our trade deals and a lot of imports of certain things, right? As somebody said, I forget which politician said recently, you know, you can't grow bananas in New York, right? Or pretty much anywhere in the U.S.
Remember that song, Ray? You can't grow bananas in New York. Wasn't that a great? That was great. I forget who that was. Go ahead, Jim. I'm sorry.
What was I talking about again? Music, right?
Bananas.
No, but, bananas.
No, no.
Food
but
security.
I was going to say, but one of the things we saw.
It was
in some of these studies, yeah. Is some of the other countries who we are having national discussions or tensions with, the Russias, the Chinas, some of the other players, have been exercising significant economic influences over countries that used to be much more U.S. reliant. Many of which are suppliers to the U.S. of some of these necessary things. South America, South Africa, you know, it's certainly been in the papers that China has been trying to make major moves in some of those areas. Pulling back U.S. aid was our first way to give it to them. Tariffs is another.
In many respects, this is about a one-day win, you know, the headlines on one day or the headlines on a series of days. And, you know, it's a short-term win. The long-term consequences, I don't know if the economists have factored that out, in large part because we really don't know where we are. Where we're going, and it's the global economy is such a sophisticated, complex machine. I can't imagine that anybody has a real good handle on what the long-term implications are going to be.
Is it outrageous of me to suggest that the rest of the world will probably be looking out for their economic self-interest and not looking at this through our domestic policy lens? In other words,
absolutely.
Yeah. Sure, Canada might not like Donald Trump, but at the end of the day, they're going to do what's good for the citizens of Canada, for example. And I assume that's true of every other country around the world.
It's sort of like the old Buy America America logo. Like, okay, I'll pay an extra $20 for that American flag because it's made in America. I think you're seeing that in, you know, that loyalty to the American product. I'll buy local because it's important for my local economy that I spend that extra, mm-hmm. you know, $2 on a dozen ears of corn because it's grown at a local farm. So you're... if you're in a certain economic zone, you have the luxury of doing that. If you are on the poverty line or close to the poverty line, you have to pay. You're buying the cheapest thing you can. You can't afford the loyalty that, you know, that
oh, no question, required. Judy. No, I'm sorry. I'm making a too subtle of a point. Whenever we talk about tariffs on the roundtable, it almost invariably becomes a conversation about domestic political concerns. And I think that puts us at risk of missing the forest for the trees. At the end of the day, this is going to be an economic conversation, not a political one.
Yes, but Donald Trump is not making a good economic case for it.
Did I mention that I don't like tariffs?
So he's making it political. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And executive orders.
Executive orders.
Yes. Don't like those either.
Yes. All right. Let's see. We'll go to just a letter or two, and then we'll take a break at the top of the hour. Let's see.
Oh, no.
I don't know. Letter's amusing, Joe.
Do you want to share with the class?
No, maybe I don't want to read the letters. No, I just checked one, and I decided.
Coward.
Not. When Bush 2 signed big tariff, big tax incentives for solar photovoltaics into law in 2007, that would have been a time for tariffs on foreign parts in order to protect fledgling domestic manufacturing of renewable energy commodities according to our more strict environmental and labor standards, delivering both national energy security and Keynesian economic stimulus in blue-collar communities. In the absence of those tariffs, the climate change-denying owner of, say, Cypress Semiconductors enriched himself with American taxpayer dollars by sidestepping the patriotic intentions of the stimulus, undermining domestic manufacturing through the creation of integrated international supply chains. So this question is those who are making money off of tariffs in certain situations and what we can do about that.
I think tariffs are very prone to grift. There will be carve-outs for people who maybe make special donations to special libraries or things. There's talk now about maybe, you know, carving out French wine or French cheese or special industries or special people that make, you know, concessions to the United States. I think that the way this is being done makes it seem like that will happen. There's talk about exempting newsprint from the Canadian tariff. I mean, I'm all in favor of that, but I understand the bias where I'm coming from with that.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Snarky Puppy providing our music. And don't worry, Ray. You'll always be our snarky little puppy.
is that really who?
Yeah. Oh, they've been around for a while. They're great.
Wow.
They're terrific. We've had some of the puppies on the show.
No kidding.
Yeah. The snarkiest of them, of course.
Great band name.
Panel@WAMC.org. If you would like to be a part of the program, snarky.
Snarky@WAMC.org.
Snarky, no, yeah, snarky the better. I was going to say, yeah, snarky the better. More snarky the better. Panel@WAMC.org. Okay, let's move on to other points, not other points, but other topics, and we'll discuss other things to check in on where our, what our panel thinks. We were just talking actually during the break about Brown University, so it was a bit of a rehearsal for the discussion we're about to have. Brown University has made a deal with the White House to restore funding. the deal, which will require Brown to spend $50 million. There's a train coming. The deal, which will require Brown to spend $50 million, comes after two other Ivy League schools negotiated with the Trump administration to restore millions in research dollars. Brown University, besieged by the Trump administration's pressure campaign against the country's most elite schools, struck a deal with the government on Wednesday, becoming the third Ivy League university in a month to reach an agreement with the White House. So we'll say that when we discussed Columbia last week, Columbia University last week, many of our panelists were quite upset over the agreement that was made and felt that it was going to be detrimental for higher education. So we talk about now Brown University. Jim, you were the one who was speaking about this during the break, so let me begin with you.
I was?
Yes. Yes.
We were just asked about some of the impact on local universities.
Yes.
I was coming
yes.
in.
But
I,
you were,
actually,
and then you
I'm
were
going
to
turn
about
it over to Sophia.
So I think the last time I was here, actually a few months ago in April, was when Harvard had made the headlines saying no, and Columbia had said, we're going to, you know, throw up our hands. So it's, you know, kind of interesting to be here now with these new developments. But I really think it's so critical, like I said last time, for these large Ivy League universities and the powerful universities with all these resources to be saying no to Trump's bullying, because it's going to make it a lot harder for RPI or small universities to be able to say no themselves when they have a lot less resources. And, you know, I mentioned it a little a few months ago. I graduated Columbia in 2024, and I remember in 2023, I believe it was, fall 2023, when the encampments were starting, it was very misrepresented on the media. When I was there on campus, the tents were very peaceful. There was just students eating, studying, speaking. Now and then someone would give a speech. But Columbia would bring in police to separate the encampments, and then the media would get their shots and then post about how violent these protesters are. And it was really disturbing. So I worry about Brown students feeling like their freedom of speech may be limited. I wonder if maybe all of this to Trump, who I think is very self-absorbed, maybe to him this isn't about anti-Semitism. It's just the fact that he never felt accepted by the Ivy Leagues. It's like an elite club. He never felt like he could really join. I mean, I know, did he go to UPenn, I believe, the last
Wharton,
2 years? Wharton School, yes. So, but, you know, it's kind of been a point of contention, right? Like, if his grades will be released, professors have not said nice things about his intelligence. So I think it hurts his little bruised ego. So I think it's more about ego for him and trying to get revenge towards the Ivy Leagues and controlling what they do in research more than anti-Semitism.
But one of the points that was brought up, and I agree, and that's a great point. One of the things that we brought up, that was brought up regularly when we were having this discussion last week, mm-hmm. When it came to Columbia University, mm-hmm. is that there is an assumption, a general assumption, mm-hmm. that once this is agreed to, that everything, you know, the fury will stop from the White House. And I don't think anybody really, I think anyone who looks at this, let's put it this way. The record doesn't show that.
No.
The record will show that this will continue. This will continue for Columbia. And also, this happened earlier this week, but Harvard has indicated that they are looking at the possibility of reaching an agreement with the White House in some way. And I'm curious of what that means and why it is so important for them, for the universities, to say, yes, let's just try to move on, give them the money, do what we are, do what they're asking, and then hope this will go away.
We say give them the money, but the money that they're giving Joe, is a rounding error on the money that they receive from the federal government. So they have every economic incentive to make these settlements, right?
I don't understand.
No, in other words, well, okay, let me back up.
I mean, they're not giving money back.
In terms of this, then I misunderstood what you said. I thought you were referring to the $50 million that Brown is settling. And what was it, 200-some-odd million dollars for Columbia?
Yes.
No, isn't it $500
million? $500 million.
Yeah. Yes. But I mean, as we've discussed on the roundtable in the past, the federal government funnels money to the universities in far greater numbers, whether it's through direct assistance through research grants or whether it's student aid, et cetera. And this is, we don't like to discuss this, but this is simply the fact of the matter. I mean, my friend Jay Green, formerly of the University of Arkansas, always says, with government shekels comes government shackles, right? And look, for what it's worth, and again, at the risk of being a smart aleck, instead of having Snarky Puppy as the music into the break, can we please play Toby Keith's How Do You Like Me Now? Because when we discussed the Department of Education in a previous roundtable, I was the one pointing out that, hey, look, the reason folks on the right have always wanted to close the Department of Education has nothing to do with the funding. It has everything to do with their kind of imposing their priors on K-12 education. Well, now here we are seeing it, people objecting to the Trump administration doing exactly to higher ed what other administrations have done, for 50 years in K-12. So, And I was reliably assured that it was, that the problem was that if you close the Department of Education or fire, half the staff or whatnot, that sends the wrong signals. So now just somebody help me out here. Do we like the Department of Education and they're imposing their agendas on schools? Yes or no? And can we be consistent if we don't like it for higher ed? Can we not like it for K-12?
Well, OK, so, I'm going to leave off of that whole issue of, quote, imposing their agendas,
Great.
Unquote.
But that's the whole. No,
because you and I could probably argue for about 3 hours or whatever.
How much time do we have left, Joe?
We're down to 44 minutes. But go ahead.
What it means to impose values. I mean, I'll just point out that even in the Brown settlement, right, Brown had to agree to implement the Trump administration's definition of male and female for women athletics, student programs, campus facilities, and housing, and has to agree not to do gender-affirming surgeries for minors, which, by the way, most universities don't do, or prescribing puberty blockers. Again, they will let people who have those prescriptions get them, but they don't block them. But so again, we're seeing an administration impose their policies very explicitly on these things. Now, the research dollars that come from the federal government are not typically politically motivated. There are some. I mean, more money goes to cancer because, number of senators are old enough to medical research in general, because, you want to live forever. But my research has always been funded by the federal government, which pays for us to have grad students
like Sophia.
Who can
then go on
to become
that.
I mean, those grants are very, very, have always been related to congressional appropriation politics, but never this direct administration stuff. In public schools, and you and Sophia are far more aware of this than I am, but boy, the past couple of years, the approach to, quote, we want to determine what our kids learn, right, I believe is hurting educational standards around the country. Because if you focus on local only, you end up with students who don't understand the world.
This may be a larger conversation that we don't have time for, but I'd love to talk about it at some future roundtable. What ought to be the federal role in education, whether it's higher education or K-12? Because it is simply undeniable, I would argue, that if you're going to have a large federal financial role It would be lovely to say, look, just send the money and don't ask questions. But that is just not the way the world works, whether it's K-12 or higher ed. So in other words, I guess I'm surprised that people are surprised.
So the Federal Acquisition Reform Act, which is the one that governs how our grants are held, monitored, et cetera, I had to, because I was a funding agent, I only had to take the 2-day training course. My actual funding people had to take the 3 or 4 month course. We're talking 18 to 20 volumes of regulations. Okay. These regulate, you know, which things that, so research money can only be spent on research. Overhead rates are negotiated by a lot of laws, things like that. You don't like executive orders. Boy, this executive order for 15% overheads are basically just a shot at saying we want to close down the major research universities. And, you know, I can go – I won't go on and on, but suffice to say that at least at the university level, there has been a very strong, exceedingly regulated model. Right. I mean, I know faculty members who've been tenured faculty members who've been fired, gone to jail, just as you might have a defense contractor president who turns out to have been corrupt. Because, again, the laws are there about that money is there supposedly to support the federal acquisition of military weapons when it's a defense contractor. Right. The research company, you know, the big companies that are now calling the shots, their PhDs were trained at all of these universities. Heck, the Supreme Court, 4 of the members went to Harvard Law School and 4 of them went to Yale Law School. And they're not split by, you know, if one of them was a training place for liberal thinking, boy, would we have a different Supreme Court than we have now. So again, you know, I think there's a lot at play here. And, you know, you can do better than I can at talking about how that plays out at the lower levels, but certainly at the university levels, our educational mission and our funding mission, research mission, have been very different. And our country has profited hugely from that research funding.
You know who I think looks very smart these days, and I don't expect anyone on the roundtable or our listeners will agree with me, but it's Larry Yarn of Hillsdale College, who years ago decided they were not going to take federal funding to avoid these entanglements altogether. And the college has flourished under him and after that decision.
Nobody knows who Hillsdale College is. Sorry, but
nobody who listens to WAMC knows what Hillsdale is.
And let's be clear,
it's the conservative Harvard is what they describe it as.
News to me, but this is not about anti-Semitism. Let's be clear, this is a ruse to bring elite colleges to their knees. Though the federal role in education, I can be clear about it, should not be to have a federal monitor on the Brown University campus, tattletaling back to Washington anytime they disagree with a protest or something. I mean, that's something Brown has gone a step further than Columbia did. I mean, at least Columbia had an independent monitor. Brown has agreed to a federal monitor. They do not like what they consider woke culture. This is all about liberal teachings. Conservatives have got this under their skin for the longest time. I mean, just go back to congressional hearings that Elise Stefanik championed, where she took it as a win for every college elite college university president she could bring down. I have often gone to an elite college's 990s and looked at how much money they get in federal grants, and it's amazing. It is a ton of money, but this is a lot of this is our research industry in many respects, and you have to bringing that to their heels is not what this effort is about. It is all about the culture that's being taught,
and it's using those research dollars as the bludgeon for the culture. See, if it really was separate, we'd be talking very differently. But when you go to a Cornell or a Harvard or something, say we're taking away $900 million of your funding, which, by the way, is not primarily funding your classes. It's funding your graduate student thinks. Hillsdale's a great example. Hillsdale has, I believe, one PhD program, and it's in the Graduate School of Statesmanship. So I don't believe they have significant science programs. I don't believe that they are turning out students who are going and working in big tech companies. I don't believe they're turning out a lot of students who are creating startups in the tech industries. So, and I include medicine in that. Big pharma, you know, whatever you may think of them, and I'm not always their biggest fan, desperately reliant on the biomedical research that goes on at universities. I would not be alive today, probably at my age and some of the things I've had, had it not been for research done at some of the medical schools down in New York City, because they were able to treat a couple of things that 20 years ago wouldn't have been treatable. My child has multiple sclerosis. 20 years ago, the life expectancy with multiple sclerosis was about 15 years. Now the life expectancy is normal life expectancy. As long as one of these medicines that have been developed over the past decade will work in your case, which is mostly the case, and there are a number of experimental ones coming along. Clinical trials on several of those have now been held up because the NIH is no longer funding those. Now, again, that to me has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. That has nothing to do with government, quote, policy calling the shots. That has to do with using that money to set a political agenda or to, as Judy said, to reinforce the politics.
I just want to say a note about the anti-Semitism because, and I said this last time this topic came up on the roundtable, I just don't think it's appropriate to minimize it. I think it's a real thing. I'm not saying you are, Jim.
No, I'm president of a synagogue. Believe me. I
don't want to pick a fight with Judy either, but to say that that's a ruse, I think. I respect your opinion, but I also respectfully disagree. I think it is a genuine problem, especially on elite campuses.
It may be a problem on elite campuses, but it's not a prime concern of the Donald Trump presidency.
And I will certainly say it hasn't been a problem for Hillsdale College, but of course that may be because I haven't looked at the actual figures on their Jewish enrollment, but I will bet you it's not real, real high. Mm.
So if you disagree, can I ask why? Sure. What strong anti-Semitic things are you seeing in higher ed or K-12? What do you think?
In higher ed, and look, you were there. I take that seriously. The fact that you had eyes on the encampment, I did not. But there were no shortage of reports about, and I believe even some lawsuits with Jewish students on various campuses. Claiming violations of their rights, their freedom of movement restricted, their inability to just be physically harassed, physically accosted or harassed. One university, I don't think it was Columbia, but it may have been, where administrators advised Jewish students to not be wear religious garb, which just to me is unthinkable on any college campus in the year 2025. Those are serious things.
No, absolutely. I agree. And I will say that from what I know of and saw from the encampments, they were never anti-Jewish. They were anti-genocide, and they were protesting. And they included Jewish students. They were protesters as well. Yeah. The protesters were Jewish and non-Jewish students. So I definitely want to point that out.
And again, many of the rules and regulations put in place are being applied to all universities, whether they've had anti-Semitic issues or not. So, for example, my university has, RPI has had very little history of any kind of violence. In fact, within a month of the October 7th attacks, we had had a university-wide, every religion invited prayers for peace meeting. Mm-hmm. I do want to apologize. According to what I can find now, Hillsdale does have Jewish students. They have no officially listed in their enrollment graduate, but one of their professors estimates there are 10 to 20 Jewish students there. You know, again, you can talk about these things. You can talk about it. You know, I go back to Vietnam protests where much of the struggle was over the war, but a lot of it was also for other issues having to do with youth and youth having their own political opinions and on and on and on.
Because they couldn't vote but could be sent to war, right?
That too. Yeah. But would you...
Let me just do two quick listener letters, and then we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll discuss more, and we'll go to other topics and finish up the program. Ross says, never forget, education is kryptonite to conservative Republican ideology. And then Carrie says, has anyone noticed that Columbia, Harvard, and Brown all have prominent law schools? The Project 2025 masterminds are all about destroying the rule of law. Perhaps it's not a coincidence that they are going after schools that teach students to be lawyers. Mm-hmm. All right. We will take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We will have a half hour to go through more stories and more discussion on these matters. We welcome your input, panel@wamc.org. We would love to hear from you. panel@wamc.org. First, these messages, and then news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Jim Henler, Judy Patrick, Robert Pendicio, and Sophia Quisto. And we are thrilled to have all four here to discuss issues of the day. We will go to 11 o'clock this morning, and we welcome you, panel@wamc.org. Let's see. I want to go to a new report regarding crypto. The White House is urging, quote, pro-innovation mindset to crypto in this new report. It is 168 pages. The White House called on banking regulators, tax officials, and U.S. lawmakers to implement policies that would advance the crypto industry's agenda. The report was largely an elaboration of policy proposals the White House had already backed, crystallizing the Trump administration's permissive approach to crypto regulation. In the pages, it calls on banking regulators, financial authorities, tax officials, and U.S. lawmakers to implement policies that would advance the industry's agenda. Comparing crypto to world-changing inventions like the railroad and the internet, the report said the United States should adopt a pro-innovation mindset toward digital assets and ensure that crypto becomes a hallmark of the new American golden age. Jim Henler, is America ready for a new American golden age?
You know, Joe, I'm going to riff off of that golden age in a minute because it has a meaning in this context. So let me start with a misunderstanding of crypto, right? The underlying mechanism is very mathematical and things, and so everyone focuses on that. And Bitcoin, which was the first really big one, had a very specific way they did things that also had to do, which was very, you know, meant people would have to use big energy server farms and things like that to find the Bitcoins. That's not how most cryptocurrencies work today. So a cryptocurrency works today essentially as follows. I'm going to decide tomorrow that I want to create Jimcoin. And I will tell you, you know, based on market forces, like how much my friends will pay for them, how many U.S. dollars it takes to get a Jimcoin. And then, of course, I can do that for other currencies too. Now, Joe decides to create the Joecoin. And because I want to read books and Joe has far more knowledge than I do about books, Joe tells me it will take me 8 Jim coins to buy 1 Joe coin and a certain number of Joe coins to buy that the mission book, right? It's barter in a certain sense.
I feel like I'm at a disadvantage because when you say it that way, it makes it sound like my coin is joking.
Yeah. Joseph. Let's call them Joseph coins.
Sorry. Joseph coins. Sure. All right. Donahue
right.
coins.
Yeah. Good, yeah. But I understand the point.
J.D. coins, but that might be confused with someone else's.
Yes. There you go.
But, okay. So, and currencies are generally backed up by something.
Right.
Bitcoin was backed up by this mathematical tool, but that really corresponded roughly to labor, right? The U.S. currency is backed up by dollars. Gym coins would be backed up by a market of how much is willing to pay for those versus the Joseph coins or the whoever, right? So how come Trump was able to come in and say, I'm just creating a new coin, right? Because there is no regulate, like that. But what's being argued for is sort of changing the international monetary standards to allow a lot more individual currencies. Hmm. So strangely enough, I'm actually in favor of regulation of a lot of the crypto. I'm not sure I would agree on the particular regulations that this administration is suggesting. I don't see that it's a step towards a modern future. I see it's a step towards the old days when I would say, I'll give you 3 sheep for that chair you just made.
I'm more comfortable with that than crypto.
Just if you just think of it as a barter system, and as a particular crypto gets larger, it obviously has more volume, which means it has more market forces, which means it has more power. So,
but sorry, if I clarifying question, please.
Yeah.
If it's not backed by labor, if it's not backed by gold, by a dollar standard, etc., then it's just imaginary, right? I mean, this strikes me as a bubble waiting to happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, and you know, there are people who want to regulate it for the positive side of, hey, you know, if you're going to go out and create your own currency, there should be some rules about what you're allowed to do and do it, you know, the...
But isn't the point of crypto...
So, for example, there was one crypto which was essentially claiming a lot of backing in dollars but didn't have them, and that guy is now in jail. I mean...
You know. My impression, because, you know, the folks who seem to love this are my libertarian friends. My impression is their attraction to crypto is precisely because it takes the regulators out of it. It's a stateless currency, right? In other words, the usual regulatory interests are not there. So, in other words, as soon as you – and I'm kind of talking out of my ear here because I simply don't understand this.
Yeah.
Once you talk about regulating crypto, it's almost as if it's no longer crypto, right?
Well, that becomes the issue. That's exactly the point. So, in other words – on one hand, let me use a not great analogy, but
please,
for all intents and purposes, to many people, the stock market has absolutely no relationship to the actual companies that are involved. To many investors, to intelligent investors, it is, but to a lot of people, it's just this is going up, this is going down. My broker says that. Yeah, speculation. So, in theory, you could create a completely fictitious stock market that was not tied to real companies but was tied to whatever the heck you know, you wanted to tie to, how many newspaper stories were produced about any given company, or even just how many people were willing to back it just for fun, right? They like the names, right? Mm-hmm. Crypto has some of that same Wild West frontier concept. Mm-hmm. Now, regulating it has a number of different points. One is simply to say, can you just go out and declare one without showing that you have the backing for at least the initial investment, right? That one makes sense to me. That's, you know, saying you can't open a bank and tell people they can give you money unless you can assure that you can live by some banking rules that, among other things, says you'll be able to give them the money back if they ask for it, right? Crypto, you can't necessarily get what you put into it back, but if I buy 100 crypto coins, I get 100 crypto coins worth of that currency if I sell it, right? So, I mean, it really is not a complicated idea. It's a complicated technology that backs it up. Mm. But that technology is really just to make sure that, you know, if I say I own 50 gym coins and I put them in my wallet and I lose my wallet, right, and someone else finds them, then they suddenly have the coins and I don't. With crypto, I don't have them, but neither does anyone else.
Right? Here's
Which,
something
by the
that's
way,
even,
pushes everyone else.
Something that's even less complicated. A year ago, Donald Trump needed money for his campaign in the crypto industry, ponied up $200 million. Yeah. And as a result, the Trump administration has let the crypto people write their own regulations.
Yes.
And Donald Trump has his own meme coin. He's made a ton of money. His two sons are involved in some stable coins and some cryptocurrency. They're making a ton of money. You know, the only thing that's really interesting, there's a story in Wired this morning which says that, you know, the Trump administration is saying, you guys are asking for a little too much. Maybe you need to be a little bit more patient about how far we're going to go in terms of deregulating you. So I think this is not an investment opportunity for anyone who is going to put all the retirement money in it. And I think we really need to take a hard look at the fact that one in five of people of the top administration people in the Trump administration are heavily invested in crypto.
I don't want to. We're doing that thing again where we drift into looking at everything through the lens of politics. And it's while it's interesting, since Jim, you know so much about this, I'm fascinated. I'm learning a lot from you about this. My question for you is, just give me your best take on this as a U.S. industry. I mean, how should we be thinking about this? Okay, yes, the hyperbole about the golden age and comparing it to railroading and the internet, I assume divide by six. Is there? What's our interest economically and as Americans in this industry? What should it be?
So my fast answer to that is I don't know. And I don't know for two reasons, right? One is because simply there's a lot of economic issues to speculative markets that aren't backed or are backed or et cetera. But the other one is because it's not a U.S. thing, right?
Right.
You could imagine creating rules that will say if you want to exchange, you know, have a cryptocurrency that's recognized in America, then X, right? So, you know, again, when a foreign country starts printing its own money and they want to enter the international money markets, there are essentially rules they follow, right? There are cryptocurrencies all around the world. I can go buy British crypto coins. I can go buy Chinese crypto coins. I mean, so I don't see it as a flourishing, quote, American industry. Now, technologically, a lot of the places that have the largest stakes in it at the moment are U.S., and that's partly because U.S. large investors, non-corporate investors, so literally individual speculators, were willing to take these chances. And, you know, Bitcoin has had times where if you got one in the early days, it was worth nothing, and other times where it's been worth a billion, I forget what the individual coin's max was, but it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And to find them, you had to do something with computers and things like that, which is why this all got tied together. But again, the Trump kids coins, Trump's coins, all this, none of those require you to go, quote, find them on the street.
Yeah.
They require you to pay them X dollars, and that number is set at the beginning by them and eventually goes up and down based on the market for those particular kinds of coins based on whatever mechanisms they want to brag about.
See, this is the part that makes my eyes glaze over, because it has felt to me in my ignorance as if crypto is purely a speculative play, that it is not a true currency. That, I mean, I like your description of Jim coins and what are we going to call them now? Dollar hues?
Nicely
played.
I used to be the one who could come up with a crypto.
But is anybody actually using it that way, using crypto to buy real goods and services?
So
PayPal, Venmo.
That's dollars, right? At least when I use Venmo.
Well, so what happens is
we can purchase it on Venmo.
Again, if I go to Europe and buy a whole bunch of euros, and then I come to the U.S. and I want to trade them for dollars, there's rates that are set.
Sure.
Right. Now, imagine if every bank could set its own rate. Then I could go shopping around and say, okay, I'm going to take my euros here and trade them for, you know, this bank is giving me a better price on my euros than that bank, right? And, you know, that does fluctuate by cents, but not by hundreds or thousands of dollars. Okay. crypto is purely speculative in that sense.
Okay.
Right? It is not governed by many of these rules. Now, there are some rules that actually were not designed for crypto, but were designed for financial instruments and financially backed things. So in other words, again, if I say you should buy the Jim coins because I have $1 million in the bank, so I'm going to guarantee to pay you back if we fail, and then we fail and it turns out I didn't have the money and I can't pay you back, then I've broken laws.
Hey, and I hate to bring this back to politics, but you know what? It's the government's responsibility to protect the American consumer from schemes that will rob them of their life savings.
Yeah,
and issue some regulations.
And so regulation on cryptocurrency that would turn it into something more like the international monetary system.
Or even the commodities market, I would think.
Or the commodities. Yeah. Actually, commodities market might even be a better analogy. But something that had a regulated market. At the moment, though, it's essentially an unregulated market. And what the regulators really want, or I'm sorry, what the Trump regulation looks like originally, and now, as you say, they're even pulling back a little, was let everybody try what they want. Don't, you know, even pull back some of those rules about you have to have it fully backed on start and things like that. And in fact, that wasn't the rules, and it's unclear whether some of the ones that have been discussed politically had those backings when they started. They just luckily, quote unquote, for the owners, got enough investors that they could then put that money behind and say, yes, we do have that much money as we said we had at the beginning, and no one can really tell was it there at the beginning or not, nor is it legally mandated. So again, there are crypto schemes that do allow you to, quote, discover the coins by mechanisms. Those are mostly gone away. Now it's mostly purely a commodities market.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and finish up for this edition of the Roundtable panel. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Last call for letters for our panel this morning. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We are talking, whether you want it or not, we're talking about crypto and making sense of it and going around the room here. Sophia, what do you make of all this?
Well, I wanted to add that last spring, a colleague introduced me to some research on crypto that I found really interesting. I learned that I kind of look at crypto from a mental health lens. I didn't know before that most young men invest in crypto. I think it was like 42% I'm looking at. It's almost half, men ages 18 to 29. Yeah, it's very striking.
Wow.
So, and men are way more likely to invest in crypto than women. And so when I think of regulations I would like to see the government put on crypto, I think of regulating it like a gambling addiction. Men get a dopamine release when, you know, they're investing in something that's high risk, high reward. So this is a thing that is apparently happening a lot with millennials and Gen Z, with young men. So one solution that my colleague and I were discussing was, what if you could only invest in crypto at a physical location? To kind of, like, when you have to go to a casino to gamble, like that sort of thing. So maybe it would...
Used to have to,
yeah. Of course, I know online gambling is huge. But trying to think of ways that could educate young men and young people more on making wise financial decisions and trying to prevent addictions from forming.
Not your point, but I'm pleased to hear that 42% of 18 to 29-year-old American men are investors. I'm serious. That's not a bad thing.
I mean, it shows, I guess, they care.
That's right.
I mean, I feel like generally in my generation, or maybe it's just speaking from my point of view, but there seems to be a sense in my Gen Z generation that our financial future is very uncertain, that we won't be able to buy a house one day, that we may always be renting. So maybe this is how we're responding to it. Maybe it's, well, maybe we need to take these high-risk investments or more of a risk investment. I think we definitely lacked financial literacy education in high school and college. I think it's either kind of assumed that you figure it out on your own or you grow up with skills. So I wonder if maybe a lack of financial literacy courses in high school and college is contributing to the problem.
And clearly you have a demographic difference there. I haven't studied the actual numbers, but obviously if you don't have money, you don't have money to invest in crypto.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, I have a 27-year-old daughter who is in the mortgage and housing market right now, Sophia, so I am living through what you're describing.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to some letters. We go to Diane. Robert, in plain English, it's an elaborate Ponzi scheme. That from Diane.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up.
Let's call it what it is, a grift. In particular, the president is using it as a backdoor payoff to the president that is unregulated to get favors. The founding fathers could never have imagined this emolument. That from Joseph. Then, who probably also has Joseph coins, we go to Margaret. To me, investing in crypto has a lot in common with collecting Beanie Babies. It's worth whatever someone else is willing to pay for. Am I missing something? That is Margaret checking in on crypto and the Beanie Baby movement.
It's Beanie Babies, but you pretend that they're full of numbers, and that if those numbers don't add up exactly right, then you lose your Beanie Baby.
Hey, and Beanie
Baby. In fact, it's got nothing to do with the Beanie Baby.
And for a while, those Beanie Babies were very valuable. But you go to a yard sale now, you can pick them up for like a quarter a piece.
Oh, no. I saw somebody with an entire.
People do have addictions.
Yeah, like a tote for $2. You could just get like 50 of them, and, you know, whatever. Mike says, thank you for your illuminating discussion today. All I can really say about crypto is that he was adorable in the Superman movie. Well, and that's true. Absolutely. Was. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate that. All right. We are just about out of time. I think we have time maybe to sniff around one more story here, and I don't think this one will take very long, but the former nominee for president, the Democratic nominee for president, has decided that she will not run for California governor. Kamala Harris made the announcement yesterday, leaving the door open to another run for president in 2028 and ending speculation that she would seek the highest office in the state of California.
She clearly didn't want the job. I think, and the prospect of her running for president again is pretty low. I think women, we know, we can see the writing on the wall. The American electorate is not ready to invest us with the power to run the country.
Wait, are you
sadly
saying
as it is,
her prospects, her
any woman.
But you're saying she's not going to run because of that, or she's not going to win?
No, women. First, it was Hillary Clinton. It was Shirley Chisholm first. Then it was then it was Kamala Harris. We know the American public, they are not going to vote for a woman.
It's, but if you had to bet money, you couldn't afford to lose as to whether or not she will run for president.
I'd bet money on it.
That she would not.
You know, I got some crypto money on it.
Okay.
Well, because unlike some politicians, she can gracefully accept defeat.
Yeah, and women. And women have a far greater capacity to be realists about this thing. It's another generation. Maybe we can have a woman president, but not in my lifetime, I think.
And I,
hopefully,
you know,
in mine.
Putting that aside.
Yeah, hopefully in yours.
Yeah, putting that aside for a second. Yeah. But, you know, the speculation that she's not going for governor because of a potential run may or may not be true. But it's also the fact that, could you imagine the relationship, the already strained relationship between California and the federal government if Kamala was the governor? And I mean, she could see the writing on the wall that, you know, the Trump administration would come out with a lot of guns blasting.
She's running for president. Book it. I'll take the bet, Judy.
I wouldn't be surprised if she puts her name in.
Yeah.
But I'm just
not saying she's going to win.
I'm not saying that, but I also think that the decision not to run for governor is a smart decision, because even if she won, it would not be a helpful thing for either California.
I get like an Al Gore 2004 vibe, where, you know, there's a lot of speculation, and then,
you know, suddenly there's a hot tub sketch on SNL, and they're like, all right, I'm not going to run anymore.
I mean, polls are meaningless this far out, but I think she's considered the front runner for the Democratic
Nominee. Well, of course. Yeah, I mean, she has the name recognition, sure. But it'll be interesting to see. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are a lot other ways for her to make a difference, and I think as a realist, she's seeing that.
Hmm.
All right. We'll end there. Put a bookmark in it, place your crypto bets with Robert. My thanks to all of you, and Sophia, delight to have you here. Thank you very much for being with us.
Me.
Really nice to have your voice on our program. All of you, thank you. We'll be back right after this.